Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hey everybody, this is Dr. John back with the latest episode of the Evolved Caveman, and I have to remind myself what to say right there because recently I've been working on this summit, Surviving to Thriving, which came out in May and June. So I'm slow to pick up these changes. But today I'm really excited to have with me Dan Hill. And Dan is a PhD and an internationally recognized expert on the role of emotions in business, politics, sports, and popular culture. Dan pioneered the use of facial coding in business to capture and quantify emotional responses, and his company, Sensory Logic, has done market research work for over half of the world's top 100 B2C companies over the past 20 years. Dan's business book, Emotionomics, was chosen by Advertising Age as one of the top 10 must-read books of 2009. Dan has been a pundit for CNN, Fox, MSNBC, and Reuters. He has also made appearances on ABC's Good Morning America and NBC's The Today Show. He has received front page coverage in the New York Times for his work in pro sports. He's also written 8 books, one of which is here with me today, Famous Faces Decoded. So welcome, Dan. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thanks so much.
So there's all sorts of places I want to go in this because I'm an emotion geek in the best sense of the word. I'm passionate about it. I believe strongly in it. It's something I've pursued for almost 30 years. So how did you get into this field of emotion?
I was trying to ghostwrite the book for the president of a consulting firm I was working for. He knew a guy at IBM, and one day that guy sent over a fax that changed my life. It was about the breakthroughs in brain science and how much we are intuitive, emotional decision makers. The killer statistic, the conservative estimation, at least 95% of our mental activity is not fully conscious. Basically blows the cover off the baseball in terms of this notion that we are rational, always in charge of our destiny kind of situation, and opens it up to what I think is a much more profound reality, that we're kind of dimly aware at times of what's going on for us, that emotions really drive our outcomes, that they're so central to life. And I was absolutely fascinated. In fact, my hands were trembling when I finished reading the article. That's how excited I was.
Yeah, and I think if I can jump in there, I think it's Joseph Ledoux's quote, and I'll paraphrase here, but it's, we are not thinking beings that feel, we are feeling beings that think. So
that's
the feeling
DeMotto.
Is dominant.
Yeah.
Oh, is it Anthony DeMotto?
Yeah. But okay. But it's spot on. I mean, that's one of my favorite quotes because it is so true.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. I would say 90 to 95% of the activity in our brain we're completely unaware of. And thank God that's so, because if that weren't the case, we wouldn't be able to do things like drive a car and talk on the cell phone.
Oh, absolutely.
Which maybe isn't a good idea anyway, but the fact that we can do it is amazing because all the things we do to drive the car are automatic, habitual, and unconscious. You don't think to push on the gas pedal. You don't think to flick the turn signal.
Yeah, but thank God because it allows us to function on various modes simultaneously as we need to.
Absolutely. So let's get into like brass tacks and share with me if you would, like your all-time greatest story regarding emotion.
Well, it was actually a project on the Mexican presidential race in 2012. So I come in and I watch one focus group of 25 Mexican voters live. They've videotaped the other three rooms. I have 100 people in the sample. So I watch the debate. Now, they have much more reasonable campaign seasons overseas. So there's simply one debate. And I get done and I accumulate all the data. And at 4 a.m, they throw me in the limo to go to party headquarters. So I get there and I feel like I'm in an Orson Welles film because it's really dark. It's late at night. I've got these kind of slightly seedy political characters all around. And I give my presentation. I said, you've been aiming all of your attacks on the woman from the incumbent party, but she's going nowhere. I said, you're going to win, but it's the socialist candidate, who, by the way, is now the president of Mexico, wow. Obrador. I said, he's going to surge. That's the person you should be paying attention to. And the most important guy in the meeting said to me, well, you know, Dr. Hill, you're wrong. In fact, you're dead wrong. He said, you don't know the country. You don't know the history, the politics, the issues. He said, why? You don't even know Spanish. And I said, well, yes, it's been a long time since I studied in high school, but I'm certain what I saw on people's faces, which is how much they lit up when Obrador was speaking, how much more animated their faces were. And I said, okay, we only have a few weeks till the election day. Let's just see who's correct. I was off by half a percentage point in terms of the final election results.
Wow. Nice job. Yeah, it's one of the things that I love about emotion is that they sort of transcend race and culture.
Absolutely.
There is a universality to a lot of it. Now, you know, there's debate over how much of it is universal, but I would say the fundamental emotions, the top six, are pretty much universal.
Yeah, no, the triggers can change and the social dynamics, the display rules in terms of how much you show it. You know, Mexico is likely to be different than Japan in that regard. But yes, mm-hmm. that universality is part of what makes it so exciting. I lived overseas as a boy. I studied at Oxford University. I've spoken or traveled to, you know, 65 countries. I love the universality of facial expressions and emotions in general.
Okay, so can I share a story of mine with you?
Oh, absolutely. By all means.
Oh, great. This is one of my favorite stories. So about 10 years ago, I was selected for jury duty, which they don't like guys like you and I on juries. And the judge was saying this, I don't want any hidden experts. And I'm kind of jumping up and down in the back of the courtroom like, I'm an expert. I'm not even that hidden. I'm right here. But it was a case with two defendants. They were accused of attempted murder and aggravated assault. And from the four pages of questions they gave us, it looked like it was gang related. And so I'm in this group of 120 potential jurors in a courtroom, and I'd been scheduled to speak at high schools that whole week. So I lost Monday, and I'm thinking, how do I get out of this? So the first whole day, I'm listening to lawyers, you know, question potential jurors, and all the jurors are like, oh my God, you know, I can't do this. I'm terrified. They're going to, you know, seek revenge on me. Like and they were literally palpably afraid. And I get it. So I go home that first night and I'm like, okay, let me think about this. And I thought about it all night. And then I was like, okay, I got it. So I come back the next day, and during the first session, I raised my hand. I said, Your Honor, can I speak to you privately? I have some confidentiality concerns. And she said, okay. And so at the end of that first session, she excused the potential jurors. And my hope was that the two defendants were going to be excused too. I was like, don't they have to go to the bathroom or something? But these were big guys. Like one was a heavy set Hispanic guy, probably 26. The other guy was a slight build African-American guy, about 23. And they stayed in there. So I'm just in there with the judge, a sheriff's officer, a couple of attorneys, and the court reporter. And I was like, and I was scared, right? Like they're about 6 feet away from me. And the judge is like, what do you got? I'm like, oh, shit. I said, well, you know, I've been studying microexpressions for about 5 years. And the judge was like, microexpressions? You mean like emotion? And I'm, yeah, it's emotional leakage that flashes across your face in maybe a 30th of a second. And you can't suppress it. And what I saw yesterday was enough to convince me that these two are guilty. And I think at that point, she was like, you're dismissed. But the defense attorney was like, whoa, 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 wait a second. Would you mind sharing with us what you saw? And I was like, okay. And I said, so yesterday I was sitting over there so I could see the defendants' faces when, Your Honor, you read the charges of attempted murder and aggravated assault clearly, or to the defendants. So I could see their faces clearly. And what they showed told me they're guilty. And so the first man over here, and I pointed to the Hispanic gentleman, and I said, he showed no signs of remorse or guilt, which could mean that he had nothing to do with it. But what he did show was signs of pride and pleasure. And I said, so, you know, I take that to mean that there's some, I was trying to use big words so they weren't understanding what I was saying. So I was like, he showed some psychopathy. For those listeners, it means he's a psychopath, which means he also doesn't feel very deeply, but he does take pride and pleasure in doing something like kicking someone's ass. And so I said, you know, he showed pride and pleasure, and you see that because the shoulders go back slightly, the chin raises slightly, and there's a slight smile that crosses the outside of the lips, and it's about a 30th of a second. And I said, you know, and this gentleman over here, he did show signs of remorse and guilt, and you can see that because the eyebrows go oblique, the corners of the lips turn down, and the head sags slightly. And as I'm doing this, I'm looking at him, and he gives me a slight head nod. And I was like, oh my God, he's telling me that I'm right. And so I said, you know, so my guess is, if I had to guess, this guy over here was your, you know, he had some minor part in the drama, whether it was, you know, he was a driver or had a slight hand in the beating. This guy over here is your heavy hitter. he knows he's going to prison. It's just a matter of for how long. And he's got people on the inside to protect him. I mean, look, he's relaxed right now and he's on trial for attempted murder. And so they dismissed me. And a few months later, the verdict came out and the heavyset guy was put in for 9 years for attempted murder. The other guy was let off for lack of evidence. And so that to me kind of illustrates the power of what you can do with micro expressions.
Yeah, no, yeah, that was bingo. You got it spot on.
But it's hard to do. It takes a lot of mental processing. And ideally, and I think you've done a lot of this, is videotape someone while they're talking and then slow it down and look at the micro expressions.
Yeah, my company has some software that allows us to take video, for instance, in slow motion, freeze frame, play it back frame by frame if necessary. Particularly helpful when we're looking at responses to TV commercials where, you know, the feedback needs to be to the split second, but it helps in all sorts of situations.
So let's talk a little bit about the role of emotions and why they're so important. I mean, we touched on it earlier that, you know, we are feeling beings that think, and I do think because there's that animal part of us still in an evolutionary perspective, you know, that emotional part of the mind has been around for many, many more revisions than our rational cognitive part of the brain. And so it's faster, it's stronger, it can overpower that prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, no, all is absolutely true. I mean, Plato said we're in a chariot. There's two horses. Yeah. There's an emotional horse and a rational horse, and one is simply stronger than the other. And, you know, and especially in certain circumstances that are often the most important circumstances because, for one thing, we're very geared to other people. So emotions are very contagious between people. Mm-hmm. We have really intense emotions. It's almost like it blanks out other stuff. What's memorable to us, we'll tend to have it made a really strong emotional connection. That's why mm-hmm. we held on to it. So memories that are related to some intense situation can come flooding back. I mean, you know, we're on a show talking about guys, and I often say that for guys, especially in a conversation in a marriage where it's getting into emotional topics, it's an away game for a lot of guys.
The sports analogy. Yeah.
It's an away game because women quite honestly discuss emotions more often among themselves and guys to themselves, not so much. So they're just not as conversant, not as comfortable with it. And yet it is so central to our lives. So to improve the quality of your life, your interactions, your understanding of yourself, to try to tackle that is a really worthy endeavor.
Yeah. And I like the, you know, you mentioned Plato's analogy or metaphor. I know I always get those confused, but John Haidt has one that is the elephant with a rider on top of him, and the elephant's the emotional mind and the rider's the rational mind. And so the elephant will go where you want to as long as it suits him. But there are times when the elephant's just going to go off and eat stuff off the path and you have no control over it. You're just like, oh man, I got to wait for this to pass.
Sure. And having been in India and having ridden on an elephant, I can tell you that I had no sense of control over that elephant whatsoever. There's also a wonderful quote from J.P. Morgan who said, a man makes a decision for two reasons, the good reason and the real reason.
And the real reason is emotional. and I think, you know, that's the reason why there's that VIX indicator in the stock market. That's the fear indicator. And it tracks how fearful the crowd is in investing.
Yeah.
And when that indicator goes way up, usually the stock market goes way down.
Yeah, no, for years I used to keep an ad that particularly annoyed me. It was from an investment firm and said, we help you keep the emotions out of investment. And I thought, you know, good luck with that one. I mean, you know, there's fear and greed, and then we can move on to the other aspects of it, but it's fundamentally emotional.
Well, and I think one of the biggest places that emotion hits us, besides when we're driving on the freeway, is around money.
Oh,
and
yes.
So, you know, investing in the stock market is particularly hard because we know that money hits us deep in the brain in the insula, where it's the same area where love hits us and cocaine hits us. So those seem to be the three ones that hit us most deeply in the brain and are the hardest to think rationally about.
Yeah, no, it's security, it's the reward, the payoff, it's a way of keeping score, you know, in a relationship, you know, business or otherwise. You know, I'm the money maker, I did this for you, I spent this kind of money. That's why another quote I sometimes go back to, someone said there's just two currencies in life, dollars and emotions.
Ooh, I like that one too.
It's so true. It's just so true.
Well, so going back to what you said earlier about men being at a bit of a disadvantage around emotions compared to women, you know, you mentioned that they are not encouraged to look at emotion. I would go a step further and say that there are times in life where we are humiliated and mocked if we show too much emotion. And that really works against us, you know, where we're teased and, you know, you're called names and you learn really quickly, like, holy shit, I don't want to go there again because that's painful.
In my work in pro sports, I guess I tried to be amused by it, but they didn't want to even discuss the word emotions. You could talk about the character of an athlete, you know, which maybe got get into personality traits and so on. But emotions, no, that was like a verboten word, essentially.
Well, yeah, and that's how we're socialized in the man box culture, right? Is to be invulnerable, to not feel.
Yeah, no. In one case, in fact, just to take it into a real gender thing, if the person sent them through drills, the coach, the head coach of a college football team, and if they were the weakest performer, you know, in a certain exercise, they had to put on pink pajamas.
Yep.
Until they could prove that they had risen above that stature and beat somebody else.
And it's interesting to look at like college sports or pro sports as kind of the epitome of masculinity in a way, and that, you know, I think anger is definitely allowed in those arenas. And I think also it goes back to the two primary motivators for us as young men is to not be seen as gay and to not be seen as female. And so those are the two big motivators that are used in sports. I believe that's partly why gay men that play pro sports are really reluctant to come out as gay at the time. Because partly how we're socialized.
No, I would absolutely agree. And anger would be the one acceptable emotion probably in that context, and maybe a little happiness, pride when you've won. Yeah.
For instance, lust and stress also, maybe after the game.
Yeah, but in fact, from my research, because I've spent a good deal of time studying athletes and looking to correlate it to their performance and their career, I mean, you know, human beings are way too complicated to ever say there's a one-to-one correspondence or correlation, but disgust looks to my research to be the more reliable indicator of success.
Really?
That you really don't accept mediocrity, that there's something that, you know, stinks or tastes bad to you about just being average.
And or losing, yeah.
And so that's where I see the biggest correlation. So everyone might think it's anger, I'm going to hit and strike, and maybe that works fine in football or something. Although across really different sports, I find it's disgust.
Well, and I think even in football, if you look more closely at like offense versus defense, I think in defense, anger is probably your best emotion to tap into. And I'm talking like if you think of anger on a 1 to 10 scale of intensity, I don't think you can be at a 9 or a 10 because then you're just going to go smash the quarterback during the huddle. You know, like that's out of control. So you want controlled anger because you see that in football, right? Like, oh, what was that stupid penalty about? But on offense, I would say it's more, you know, I think disgust could enter into that. I had not heard that before. That's amazing. I also think of kind of relaxed and ready, that you want to be to some extent in a positive emotional state so that you can create on the fly, particularly as quarterback. And that's why, I mean, I think of Brett Favre kind of laughing as he gets up after he's just been smashed to the ground by a 300-pound defensive lineman. And he's just like, yeah, good job. Like, nice play.
Yeah. Well, I mean, happiness is certainly no trivial emotion because for one thing, as you would well know more than most people, I mean, it helps you brainstorm superior solutions more quickly. Mm-hmm. I am absolutely astonished by how quarterbacks can stand in that pocket, have almost no time, have huge people hurtling themselves at them and spot a receiver and handle it all. I mean, I played a little bit of football. I quit after sixth grade. I did play quarterback some. But, you know, once I put that helmet on, it was not the same as touch football. I couldn't see as well. So I am amazed by what they can do. And I think the happiness, I mean, you see that in Tom Brady. You see that in a number of quarterbacks. I would not say you see it so much in Peyton Manning, who is, you know, absolutely obsessed with being conscientious. But you do see it in a number of quarterbacks. Dan Fouts was, you know, another kind of a gunslinger. There's quite a few of them, actually.
But I could see that mix of disgust of losing and happiness or joy maybe playing the game.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think you can be fearful and be a good quarterback.
I don't think so, because that's going to freeze you very often. Uh-huh. And you don't have time to be frozen.
And you're limited in your thinking. I mean, just as, you know, it's fight, flight, freeze. So that limits your actions, but also your thinking.
Yeah, yeah. I think another thing that I've found that works well for athletes is eyes wide open, surprise. Mm-hmm. that you are alert to your circumstances. Now, surprise and fear can often overlap, of course, because we don't welcome surprises because we may have to adjust to them, which means we have to expend more energy and so forth. But surprise, I mean, I'm thinking about Tim Duncan, for instance, to switch sports to basketball. One of the things I really noticed about Tim Duncan from the Spurs was how often his eyes were wide. He was reading the court. You know, where were players? What was going on? What was the flow? You know, it's been often said that basketball is a little bit like a five-man jazz combo, and there's a lot of improv involved. So, you know, how are you going to go with it?
Well, that's interesting, too, because surprise to me is one of the few neutral emotions. Yes. So you could go either way with it, negative or positive. Because I also think that in basketball, it's interesting because I think on defense, you're better off being in a slightly negative emotional state. And then on offense, a slightly positive emotional state to the extent you could do that.
Yeah, to flow more. Yeah, no, I sometimes say that, you know, surprise is analogous to a new car for Christmas is a great surprise, and a new car accident on the way from home from work is not so great. So surprise is, yeah, really a pre-emotion. And then it's, you know, what's the verdict? What's the outcome of the surprise? Yeah. But
waiting
in the moment
the
itself, you know, the, of course, and you know facial coding well, the eyebrows lift often, the eyes go wide. You know, it's really simple and basic. You know, we have an opportunity to take in more information. We've increased our field of vision thanks to those two activities.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit, because we're getting into the election season here. And let's talk a little bit about what are the tells for spotting when someone is lying.
Sure.
That's not to say that there's lying that takes place in politics, of course.
Yeah, right. That's why in my lying epilogue, I mostly use politicians as examples, because I knew people would know that I wasn't lying when I used those examples about lying. Well, of course, first of all, there is no absolute one tell to lying. Mm-hmm. If it was that simple, it would be such an evolutionary disadvantage to have this tell that always gave away that you were lying, because human beings lie a fair amount to themselves and to others. So there is no tell for that reason. And if there was, it's also true that we would probably head to the plastic surgeon or the Botox Center to deal with it if we could. So let's go through some of the possibilities. One of them, of course, very intriguing to me, is contempt. You will actually smirk at the person you are lying to. And I believe the reason for that is that you don't respect them. You find them beneath you. There's a real aura of superiority to that smirk. You're being kind of snide about them. Mm-hmm. So Bernie Madoff did that, for instance. I mean, we had the largest Ponzi scheme of all time. Bernie Madoff did not show much emotion because he didn't really care about people a whole lot, including people who gave him money who were from nonprofits who were trying to benefit other people in life. But he did smirk. If he emoted, it was a smirk as often as anything else. And it's hard to believe his name, Bernie Madoff with the money. I mean, it's just perfect. So that's one. Another one that's quite important, and Lance Armstrong, Bill Clinton would both be candidates here. You get really angry. Like, how dare you question my veracity? Of course I'm telling you I didn't dope, you know, when I was in all the races.
Yeah, indignant.
Yeah, you're indignant. You know, how dare you come after me? That's just so much not true. A really simple, obvious one would be fear. If you took Richard Nixon and, you know, being interviewed by David Frost about Watergate, you know, Nixon had a lot to hide, was not really very adept at it. And maybe it was his Quaker background. Maybe he was raised to, you know, not feel good about lying. So, you know, that was, you know, a real issue for him. And that's where it came out. So I think that some of them, actually someone like Eisenhower and others, sometimes will show sadness. They actually have a disappointment in themselves for telling the lie. So that just shows you it can go so many different places. So you really just kind of have to look at an individual, say, what's their kind of their pattern? Do they have a signature expression? Do they have ways they tend to respond? And then you're starting to look for the discrepancies, the things that don't make sense, what I call being off emotion. That the emotion
right.
and the situation or the words just don't really fit together in a way that makes sense.
Well, it's interesting also because to me, ideally we'd know something about their psychological profile. So if we know that there's a personality disorder, that enters into it as well. You know, if there's someone that's psychopathic or sociopathic, they're not going to feel that deeply. So the emotions will be different than normal people, quote unquote. But So go ahead with your
It's what, like the trial you were talking about, because for a while I used to be on some of the networks looking at these trial circumstances with fairly psychopathic people. Mm-hmm. And one of them I remember really distinctly was this cop in Chicago. He had gone through like three wives, all mysterious circumstances. I don't know how the second and third one would have possibly married him. I guess the news clippings weren't out and available at the time. And he either tended not to emote when he really should have, like, you know, the fact that his ex-wife's parents, you know, were now, you know, without their child that they had raised. At other times he smiled when it was absolutely not appropriate to the circumstance. So something's just in the timing and the emotion that's summoned or elicited or allowed for it. Just, you know, it's just not what should happen. You know, something is definitely screwy.
Well, and so when you talk about contempt and indignance, let's go to contempt first, because that one fascinates the hell out of me in the sense that it's also one of the four harbingers of divorce. It's one of John Gottman's four horsemen of the apocalypse. And so, you know, I think of contempt in a relationship, and I think of, you know, someone thinking of themselves as above the other. You said superiority, which is spot on. Looking down at them, kind of, you know, there's anger mixed with a judgment of, you know, almost I'm smarter than you, or how could you do something so stupid, or you should have done this, or you shouldn't have done that. And so that contempt in a relationship is a really one of the most dangerous emotions.
Yeah, no, contempt fascinates me over the other six emotions from facial coding. And, you know, just to elaborate on what you said, which is all totally accurate. I mean, the textbook definition of contempt would really be a mixture. I'm thinking of Plutchik's wheel of emotions. Uh-huh. Where it falls in that wheel is between disgust and anger.
The disgust, seriously, I didn't know that. That's awesome.
The disgust is, you know, you lied to me. You know, I scorn you because, you know, you're not worthy of my, you know, respect. And the anger is, you know, you betrayed me, you're not the ally, and quite possibly I can't make the same progress, I'm not as much in control of my life as I thought I was before I discovered this about you. So that would be the conventional view of it, at least, you know, according to a number of psychologists, Plutchik and others. But where I think it's interesting is how much it also can blend with happiness. I am struck how many instances, I'm thinking of Bill Gates, I'm thinking of Tom Brady, where there's pleasure in the superiority. It is, I'm cocky, I'm confident. And confidence can be a wonderful thing, a very good thing. But, you know, that's where I think it gets to be such an interesting mix. I mean, contempt shown with anger gives you Prince, the rock star. Mm-hmm. Contempt shown with happiness often gives you Tom Brady, you know, the most successful quarterback of all time. Right. So Prince was successful, but he's a different dynamic.
And I wonder, like, you know, you mentioned disgust being connected with high performers in athletics. It makes me think of contempt too. Like, if I'm the top quarterback, I could have contempt for my opponent. They're beneath me.
Oh, absolutely.
So they don't deserve to win.
Yeah. And at this point, I guess he has contempt for Belichick because he's had enough of Belichick and wanted to move on to a different circumstance and be more appreciated. But, you know, absolutely. You can have disrespect for your opponents. I guess if you want to go back to Deflategate, even the referees and how the game is played, if you're not a Patriots fan.
And the rules, contempt for the rules.
Yeah.
The rules don't apply to me.
Back to Bernie Madoff. Yeah.
It's interesting also because how much does and I'm not saying anyone's a narcissist, I'm not pointing fingers, but how much do you think that contempt and happiness combo relates to narcissism? Or, you know, that seems like a real fine line between those two.
Oh, I think there can be a lot of similarity between those two because, you know, you are not very aware because, you know, contempt, if you're the object of the contempt, does not feel good. Mm-hmm. And if you are just kind of basking in the sunshine of being snide or feeling superior, you know, that's that fine line that gets crossed between, you know, I've been successful, I did something well, I've got some accomplishments, you know, I can enjoy that. That can be maybe the most positive way to spin this. But then you have to look at the victim or the target. And to the extent that you enjoy being above them or putting them down or making them feel their quote-unquote inferiority, then it gets much more dangerous, which takes you back to Gottman and marriage. Because of that superiority aspect, one of the analogies I sometimes make, it's a bit like, say, one of you in the marriage is in the basement taking care of the laundry and someone else yells from the second story of the house. How well do you communicate when you're yelling down two flights of stairs? Not very well. It's no wonder a marriage doesn't succeed when contempt is in the mix.
Well, it's interesting also. It makes me wonder about you know, these emotions being context specific, because I would think for someone like a narcissist, those, that contempt is going to be in most, if not all, contexts.
Yes, whereas, the default. Yeah.
You know, maybe let's give the benefit of the doubt to Tom Brady, for example, and maybe that contempt is just football specific. Versus, you know, maybe when he goes home to, what's his wife, Giselle, I guess,
yes,
that contempt goes away and there's respect for his spouse.
So and he seems to have shown respect for his teammates, as best right. I can tell. And that's obviously important, you know, as a leader or just in terms of getting along with folks on this planet, period. So, yes, it is very much to, you know, is it my joy as I walk off the field combined with my contempt for having done that well versus I'm in the locker room and we're trying to work through how we're going to deal with the second half of this game and I need to be a good team player. Yes, it can be very different by context.
Hmm. So let's go back to the tells for lying. Do you know other tells, nonverbal tells, body language?
Well, my favorite thing actually comes from Dr. Paul Ekman, of course, is the guru of facial coding, and it is make someone tell the story of why they're innocent, for instance, or what they were doing that day. Make them tell it in reverse chronological order, because it's hard for them to keep track of the pieces of their lie, their obfuscation that way.
It's so hard to lie backwards.
I think that's pretty cool. I like that one. It sounds like you do a lot more in body language than I do, so you may want to go into additional things for the listeners, but I tend to stick pretty close to facial coding and then put it in context.
Yeah, I think it's a really complex issue, and I don't have any one tell where I'm like, oh, that person's lying. And I tend to give people the benefit of the doubt. However, I have seen people lie as we move forward. It depends, as I said before, you have to know something of their psychological makeup. Yeah. If you know that there's a personality disorder, you've got a different baseline or threshold that you're dealing with. I've heard things like, you know, one shoulder up more than the other, or too much detail or not enough detail. You know, I think they're going to vary by individual. So that's the difficult part of it.
Yeah, a couple of things there. One is I should probably mention the rhythm of the emoting. That's a worthy thing to take into account, because how a emotion really happens for us should be a bit like a wave gathers, it has a crest and it lets go when it breaks on the shore. So an expression that comes on too fast, lingers for too long, goes away too abruptly, is very asymmetrical, is almost like you're trying to pull the smile on your face. Those could all be indications. I would also say people tend to camouflage with a smile sometimes. Mm-hmm. So if I see something and then I see them throw the smile across it to kind of like hide it, it could just be that they felt vulnerable and they're trying to hide it. It may not be that they're actually lying, but then it could be. There's also poker face. They're just trying to seemingly go to, I'm not going to give anything away because I'm in a vulnerable situation. But it is indeed so contextual. I knew someone who was actually raised in a Norwegian-speaking household. Her parents had been immigrants, and she got to a language exam, and she froze. She couldn't speak a word of a language she had known all of her life, because contextually she was a wonderful person, probably never told a lie in her life, but she was not good in stressful moments. Mm-hmm. And so that's why lie detectors, for instance, are not admissible in court, because you're really looking at sweat gland activity. And there's everything from the temperature in the room to how tightly the little wrap is going around the finger to how much conductive gel. And finally, just how you respond to stress.
I would not do well on a lie detector test.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, a lot of us wouldn't. Yeah.
I glisten too much.
So,
yeah. And I think anxiety comes into that in a big way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the end, I mean, I often go back to what Kierkegaard said, out of the twisted timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. I mean, we're complicated. You're not going to get to this is the rule for all time. You know, thank you very much. These are all proxies that you can use. I think they move you closer to the understanding of who the person is or how the person is in that moment that you're with them. But you're not going to have any absolutes. You're not going to have any guarantees for all time. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think to me, it's all about probability. I mean, it's kind of like being the CEO of a company. You never get perfect information. You get as much good information as you can, and then you make your best decision, a calculated risk, in terms of we're going to head in this direction. It's the same thing in this. I think that you get as much info as you can, and then you place a probability on how much is that, how likely is it this person's telling the truth or not.
Yeah, or as I say, of war, you know, no battle plan survives the first moment of combat. Mm-hmm. There is always the fog of war. There's always the complications, and you have to make decisions, and you really should go with your gut instincts, you know, that you can pick up through the face a lot more than you might imagine. We talk about actions speak louder than words. Well, these facial muscle movements are actions. They are mm-hmm. more miniature than we might be accustomed to, especially if they happen to be micro expressions, but they are there and they're worth something and they tell you something, and you really bypass your gut instincts and what you pick up observationally at your own hazard.
Well, so let's go back to this gut instinct idea, because I think, you know, that to me is sort of intuition or trusting almost the unconscious, if you will.
Yeah.
And I think that most of the men that I've known, we tend to spend a lot of our time and energy in our heads, because that's how we've been rewarded in the past. You know, you're rewarded for thinking, problem solving, getting good grades, that sort of thing. But I think we tend to disconnect ourselves from the body, which to me is where you would find gut instinct or intuition. What's your thoughts on that?
Oh, yes. And it goes into a much larger construct. I mean, I think it's so often true that in Western cultures, specifically, we think of rationality as being masculinely identified and emotions are feminine. I mean, mm-hmm. I have had in all of the speeches I've given and projects I've presented over the years, so many instances of women coming up to me and saying, thank God a guy is championing the importance of emotions and has a metric to go with it and mm-hmm. the science of facial coding, because we know emotions are important, but we don't, they're given short shrift. You know, but I think it's the same thing is true for guys. It should be liberating to know, Boris Becker, the great tennis star, German tennis star, said, I don't remember a single point I won at Wimbledon. I only remember the fear of losing.
Hmm.
So if you are as big and as accomplished a guy as Boris Becker, and that's your reality on a tennis court, I think that's liberating. I think that's the moment we say, yes, I'm a guy and I feel fear. And in fact, in my book, Famous Faces Decoded, where I looked at 173 celebrities from all walks of life, from rock stars to Hollywood to athletes to CEOs and beyond, guys on average showed more fear than the female celebrities that I studied.
Well, yeah, and I think that's one of the purposes for having this podcast is just to give men the permission to feel.
Yes.
That we're human, we are animals at some base level, and we feel things. And it's not that, you know, the emotions never left us. We turned our back on emotion. We've learned, we've been socialized not to feel. So we try to put these masks on and not reveal how we're actually feeling. And yet we still feel fear and sadness and guilt and shame and all the other emotions. And so I think the more that we can have permission to feel what it is we're feeling, and again, context specific, right? I don't want you to go to work and just start crying on your partner's shoulder. You got to be emotionally aware. But I think it's really important. And so bring up the story you were talking about, a basketball player dealing with anxiety.
Yeah. So I did some work for the Minnesota Timberwolves, a team that doesn't quite seem to catch a break and has never won an NBA championship. And the season I was particularly involved with them, Kurt Rambis was the coach. And it turns out Kurt Rambis, formerly of the Lakers, had been a psych major in college. So he was quite receptive, and they had an unusually bright general manager. And as I watched the Timberwolves, you know, Kevin Love was the star. But what I noticed was that Kevin Love's showing anxiety, showing fear, was about 20% of all of his emoting. Now, on average, because I've been doing this for a long time, 20 years plus, what I tend to see is about 8 to 10%, maybe 12%, maybe it's down to 6%. 20 is a lot. Now, it obviously didn't keep him from being an all-star, but it had some real implications because I was able to go to not just the games and sit underneath the stanchion, so I was really close to the action, but I was also at the practices. And what I noticed at the practices is that anxiety really played a role in limiting his ability to take in where his teammates were coming from and what the coaches were trying to, you know, provide to the players. He just almost froze, and the interplay that was so beneficial. He was a great player to himself, but he wasn't mm-hmm. making the team greater.
Well, part of the problem with anxiety is that our mind can get paralyzed and we yes. can't take in new information. And a lot of people will relate to that. Like if you're taking a big test and you just blank. But this was happening to Kevin on the court. And I think he even experienced a couple of panic attacks on the court and had to leave the court during a game.
Yeah. And then eventually he admitted to this, which I think is very liberating mm-hmm. and good. But in all honesty, several years before that admission, I had already concluded this was it. And so one of the things I really tried to do for the Timber was to say, here are the players I think you could and should put them with when you have that opportunity. Obviously, you're going to play the talent. But if you got crunch time or you're trying to rally when you're way down in a game or this and that, you know, here are the people that I think he's going to most successfully interact with, because obviously you're going to want Kevin on the court a lot. So right. who else can you bring into the mix to make this successful?
Well, and, you know, I've got a lot of, I guess I would say pride, or I'm very impressed by what Kevin Love has done by coming out publicly and writing articles and yep. doing interviews on the anxiety trouble or difficulties that he's faced. Because I think that gives men the permission to feel also every time we hear that. What were some of the things that you were looking at in terms of matching other players to him on the field? Was it less fear, less anxiety emoted with those players on the court? Sorry, not field.
Yes, they had a center who wasn't the most distinguished player of all times, but he was so affable and emotionally flexible. He really was evenly balanced in his emotions. So to the extent that Kevin was going to freeze or not take in information or interact well, then it was important that this guy, on the other hand, could do that. He had enough happiness, for instance, in his mix, that there was some greater degree of openness and flexibility. And so he could kind of go with, you know, well, that's Kevin, and that's how Kevin's going to behave or interact with a teammate, you know, in the huddle or this or that. And someone else who might be really given to anger might, you know, just really, you know, lash out verbally or otherwise and say, you know, what are you doing? And I can't relate to you. And, you know, you're stressing me out because I can't connect with you. So that, you know, because of playing on the front line on the formation, it was important that as a power forward, the first thing I had to look at was who was the center. And who
yeah, you're fascinating.
Put, yeah, who you're going to put in. There was another player who they sometimes would push into that role, but he had no emotions on his face. So now you have a guy who's frozen next to a guy who has no emotional displays. And I was like, especially if you're down in a game, and they were losing a lot, especially if you're mm-hmm. down 10, 12 points and trying to rally, this is not the combination to get the other three guys on the court to say, now we're all in this together. Let's summon our energies and rise to the moment.
Yeah, that makes great sense to me. Find someone that can ease his anxiety emotionally versus someone that's going to amp it up by getting angry and yelling at him.
Yeah.
What were the results based on those movements?
Well, you know, you like all consultants, you say what you can, and then, you know, what happens, happens, for instance. So, I mean, I think the general manager said to me, God, you know my players better than I do. And I said, well, there's some chance of that, at least on an emotional basis. Rambis, you know, by the time I came in, you know, they were kind of in the downward slide of the season mm-hmm. with a lot of despair setting in. So, I mean, I think he did play that combination a bit more. But one of the things I really remember about Rambis is they would have these timeouts and he would take his clipboard and go out to the middle of the court, study his notes on the clipboard. And let's say you have 2 minutes in a timeout. You come back in the huddle for the last 20 seconds. I was like, come on, you've had all this time on the side of the court to be watching the play. Why don't you just go right to your clipboard and start sharing as opposed to leaving yourself right. 1/6 of the time that was available? And so I tried as gently as I could with Kurt to suggest maybe that was a habit he could drop. That one I didn't win so much either, or even less so. So
it almost sounds like that was anxiety in Kurt.
I think it could have been. I mean, he probably knew that he was a dead man walking in terms of his contract mm-hmm. getting renewed. Maybe he just couldn't face his players. He had a kind of a bad mix. He had some personalities. There was a player who I called Chief Rain in the Face because he was the saddest looking guy I'd ever seen. And when the general manager traded for him from the Knicks, I was like, I don't think so, because my research suggests nothing against sadness. But my research suggests that in sports, particularly basketball, where you have to move fast, you know, one of the advantages, the upsides to sadness is it gives you time to ponder, to reflect. It can slow you down physically and psychologically. But when you're sprinting down the court with monsters who are all over 6 feet, this is not fabulous. And the guy was not fabulous on the court, and he was locker room poison. And Chief Rain in the Face was merely part of that motley crew that I think is probably why Rambis didn't really want to go in the huddle.
I mean, it makes me think of, so I've coached sports for about 16 years, soccer for my kids, and I would do things, sports psych techniques like circle of power. So I'd gather my team together before a game and I would get them to breathe deeply, relax, have them think of their best play in soccer in the past and then freeze it. Then you picture a circle around you on the ground and then you visualize picking that circle up in your mind's eye and you put it down around you right here, right now. And that puts you in the same physiological state that you were in when you made that great play. And the first time I did this, the soccer team went undefeated and I was like, wow, that's kind of cool. Wow. And after a couple seasons, my kids were swimming. So I went to the coaches and I said, hey, I got this exercise. Do you mind if I run some swimmers through it? And swimmers started doing it. And the results were so astounding that the next year I just sat there. I kind of felt like Lucy in the Peanuts, you know, just like doctor is in. And all the swimmers would come to me before their race. And what it does is it relaxes you. It dealt with their anxiety and it also oxygenated the blood. It also put them in a space where they felt successful already. And then generally they dropped 10% of their time. Now, after that, you know, it would plateau again because I was just one tool, but the results were 90-something% of the kids dropped time after doing that, which was incredible.
Well, I was on a swim team as a boy, and I would have done anything to drop some time because I was not a great swimmer. But I actually worked for the U.S. Olympic team for high diving, helped in the training just before they went down to Rio. And what I discovered there is actually the almost counterintuitive thing. They were having a routine where the diver upon the board would, you know, make eye contact with the coach down below. And
why?
I found that was actually a bad move often because it was accompanied by a smile. And although smile can be great for being more expansive in your thinking, as you would know, again, better than most people or almost everybody, smiling can also have another result, which is that you get a little bit sloppy with the details. You get almost too comfortable, too relaxed. I mean, I would never be relaxed on a high dive, believe me. That would leave me terrified at every moment. But these very accomplished divers would flash the smile. And I was there at the Olympic trials in Indianapolis, and I, you know, recorded the scores and the facial expressions of the divers using binoculars. And I came back to the guy and I said, you got to knock out this eye contact with the smile being exchanged. I can tell you that the best result is just slightly muted anger by the diver before they go into the dive, because anger can focus you. And I said, that's the emotion you want. It is not smiling. And I found the same thing was true when I worked with semi-pro golfers. I went down to Arizona State, a woman who was running the independent consulting, but also working with the women's golf team, which was a national champion. And we spent a whole day out on the putting green, and I just watched the golfers. And I found that in that case, both happiness and contempt were the least reliable correlations to putting well. Slight anger was the best.
Well, and there's also, they've done studies on the peak performance word where they looked at golfers putting. Three conditions. One was think whatever you want when you're putting. One was think about your form. One was think one word that encapsulates the entire act of putting. And the group that did the best was the group that focused on a single word. And the conclusion was that you want to stop that conscious mind from thinking however you can and let your muscle memory take over to do what it's done hundreds of thousands of times and can do far better than your conscious mind can do. So what you're looking for is some way to shut up the conscious mind. And one of the ways, the best way to do that is to come up with one word, it seems, that encapsulates the entire act. And the same thing can be true for baseball, right? It's, you know, contact, it's power, it's, you know, some people say rope, it's like pulling a rope off your shoulder, but you want to just focus on that one word so you're not overthinking.
Yeah, no, that's one of the reasons I love sports. I used to play a lot of pickup basketball, and I remember one time at the end of the game, you know, I had to make the shot if we were going to win, and the guy, I'm a left-hander, and the guy was just, you know, staying with me, but he forgot that I was left-handed, and I didn't have any great Larry Bird moves to shake free, but he left just enough space with me being a left-hander, and from about 35 even more feet out from the basket, I heaved it up at the buzzer, and it swished. And the guy said to me, my God, that, you know, you were moving full speed, going sideways away from the basket, basically long ways out. That's incredible. You must practice that shot all the time. I said, never in my life have I taken that shot under those circumstances. It was the power of intuition. I just was in the moment. I had to be in the moment. The moment was about to be over. The buzzer was going to go off. Unfortunately, it worked out.
Wow. So this has been a fantastic conversation. I have greatly enjoyed this. Anything that I didn't ask you that I should have?
Well, I didn't expect us to go into sports quite so much, but
I love sports.
But that's perfectly fine with me. I think it gave us a chance to bring in these different emotions and talk about them. We've hit, I think, every emotion at this point, even brought in sadness here eventually, thanks to Chief Rain in the Face. So, no, I think we did okay.
And where can people, let me put your book up here first. So this is a copy of Dan's book, Famous Faces Decoded. He's written 8 books. And where can people find out more about you or where to get the books?
The easiest place, the one-stop shopping, is to go to my website, which is the obligatory 3 W's, and then sensorylogic.com, as in your 5 senses, because there you can order the books if you're so inclined. You can, you know, see some of my speeches, other appearances, things I've been involved with over the years. So it's really all there. I do also have a blog called Faces of the Week, where I try to take something out of the headlines that has an emotional dimension and a chance to grab a photograph and analyze it using facial coding. And that's at emotionswizard.com. So HTTPS, the 2/ and emotionswizard.com, emotions plural. So you can follow it there, you can subscribe, whatever you'd like.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you for sharing your expertise.
Oh, absolutely. Had a good time. Thanks, John.
And to the listeners, thanks for tuning in. Be sure to rate, review, and share so we can get the word out more broadly. Thanks so much, and that's it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman.
Thank you for listening to The Evolved Caveman Podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.